is... Wow! What a week.
What a week. Politrix.
Eta, dumelang, sanibonani. Welcome to another episode of Wow, What a Week. Hashtag Politrix. This week on Wow Politrix, we go straight to the front line of one of South Africa's most debated issues. Our borders. He's the commissioner and CEO of the Border Management Authority, the man tasked with bringing order to ports of entry, tightening security, modernizing systems, and restoring public confidence in how South Africa manages movement in and out of the country. The BMA was created to end fragmentation between departments like Home Affairs, SAPS, and SARS, but has it worked? Are our borders more secure? Is corruption being tackled, and is South Africa striking the right balance between economic openness and national security? Joining us today is Dr. Michael Masiapato, Commissioner of the Border Management Authority. Commissioner, welcome to Wow Politrix.
No, thank you very much, Fresh. I'm really excited, you know, to be part of, you know, the conversation.
Oh, great.
No, very much great.
Can we deal with the elephant in the room? The fact that when we were younger, we used to party together.
Yeah, no, indeed. I mean, obviously, you were in the front end. You wouldn't know. But yes. Obviously, I was part of some of those sessions.
Yes.
I was in, you know, in Orlando East when one came to Gauteng.
Yes.
And it was on that basis that, you know, the Zawalaza aspect was happening at the time.
So you came to Gauteng from where?
I came from Gauteng from Limpopo.
Yes.
I came from, you know, a village called Skimini Village in Limpopo. Obviously, as you will know, after having done every other thing that side and having done even some bit of a undergraduate degree at University of Venda, I came to Gauteng. Mm. And that was around your 1999 time. And on that basis, I came and I stayed in Orlando East.
Yes.
And it was on that basis that, you know, as a young fellow, obviously, and you were tops at the time, obviously, with those, you know, those dancing stuff.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Now, in your current job, you're dealing with people all the time. Before you were commissioner, what would you say is the job or position that best prepared you for where you are right now?
Sure. I think that will be a very tough one, particularly because in terms of the circle that I've moved, you know, I obviously started in a lot of other, you know, other areas.
Yes.
But the latest positions I've been in were mainly in the intelligence environment.
Mm.
And on that basis, there hasn't been much interaction with people.
Yes.
But I would say the position that would have kind of prepared me for the level of interaction one is doing now is where I actually started. I started at a trade union.
Mm.
It was called BIFAW, that is Banking, Insurance, Finances and Assurance Workers Union.
Mm.
And we were in Marshall, you know, in Marshalltown here in Johannesburg.
Yes, sir.
And obviously in that environment, obviously in the trade union space, you have to be dealing with a number of people.
Mm.
You know, we recruited people in the banking sector, finance sector, assurance sector, and all of those sectors. And obviously you had to interact, you know, with a number of people in terms of, you know, dealing with the actual work.
Yes.
And ultimately having to deal with your shop stewards, you know, on the ground level and all of those, and the members themselves.
Mm.
So I would say that that is the kind of position that would have prepared me for the level of the issues I'm dealing with now.
Yes, sir.
Well, Doc Fresh and the listeners, good morning. You know, it's so funny that the last time I sat with Dr. Masiapato, we're in a boardroom during the formation of the BMA.
Ah, yes.
And I never imagined that he can be part of the Zawalaza gang. So I'm hearing stories today. But you know, Doc, just, you know, going through a follow-up question with what Fresh was asking about your background and where you come from. In those difficult circumstances, especially in the security cluster or intelligence gathering cluster, what was the most hard lesson you learned throughout the process?
Yeah, I will say one of the key lessons one had actually learned is the fact that, you know, running a country is very complicated.
Mm.
Running a country is very much sophisticated. You know, under normal circumstances, people get exposed to what they see in the front end.
Yes.
And they do not necessarily know, you know, the complexities, you know, of the work that is actually happening in the back end.
Mm.
And I think under normal circumstances, South Africa in particular, because of people not being exposed to that, in many instances, we also don't appreciate the work that is being done by our operatives in that particular space. And I want to be very practical. You know, one of the examples that I always give in this instance is to say that if you have people that are actually are bombed out there, whether in the form of suicide bombing, for example, or you have some malls, you know, in other places having been taken over by some, you know, some individuals and all of those kind of issues. And you ask yourself that, why are we not having those kind of things, you know, in South Africa as yet? I'm not talking about crime. I'm talking about highly sophisticated conventional crimes where a mall is taken, some suicide bombers and all of those kind of issues. It's because there are certain people that are actually working in the background, you know, and because their work is not meant to be in the front end, we don't see them and we don't see it and therefore we don't appreciate them. So that is basically what I will say one has learned to indicate that there are people who are not sleeping in the back end doing the work so that in the front end we are able to enjoy life as we are supposed to.
You know, Doc, that's one thing I've lamented before on this podcast. That one of the reasons I appreciate the intelligence community is that they are the unsung heroes that put out fires we had no idea existed.
Definitely.
And often we think, haona ntho etsala.
Yeah, definitely.
But there's fires that will be put out that we'll never know about because it might be a security issue. And that to all of our intelligence men and women out there, keep up the good work. Often it's thankless work. Often you don't get the applause or the medal. But Ralebona.
I think the challenge to South Africa, you know, not having insurgents and people demanding accountability from intelligence officials, it's because of the democracy and the openness and the rights the constitution has made people to start demanding things that we can't even talk about.
Exactly.
And in the few instances where I have seen, whether as a diplomat or in the border management, the government responding on serious matters. If you recall how I actually became into the media space, it's when there were allegations that Al-Qaeda is going to bomb malls in South Africa in 2010. And the government had countered that long before the Americans can run with that. They came out with. So our intelligence, if they do proper work and don't get involved in political squabbles, I think we've done well as a country so far.
Absolutely.
But also that being a peaceful country, we are peace-loving people, except the crime.
Sure. Yeah. Doc, what would you say shaped your thinking about about governance the most? Would you say it's a book, experience, a person, a mentor maybe?
Yeah, I think obviously one has been into the academic space for the longest time.
They don't call you doctor
and,
for nothing.
You know, and on that basis, that had effectively shaped most of my thinking, governance-wise, and all of the sophistications. I mean, I was, somebody was basically asking me that, is this thing real or is it an error? You know, I remember they were introducing me in one of the platforms.
Ah, yes.
And somebody was saying, yeah, this man has 2 PhDs. And these guys were saying, what? You know, so basically, I mean, one of my PhDs I did at University of Johannesburg has purely been on governance issues. Actually, at VETS, not the Joburg one. The Joburg one I did, it was on intelligence coordination related issues. And the one I did at VETS was the one on governance issues. So that is basically what shaped me, because part of the study itself was also including issues of systems theory in terms of understanding how, you know, various components link together and how do you make something, you know, coherent? How do you make the center to hold and how do you make sure that the ecosystem becomes accountable and is properly interlinked with each other aspect of it. Yeah.
So at an academic level, if anyone is perfect for this job, it's you.
Now I didn't know that he's got 2 PhDs. Now I know why Elia got offset.
Yeah.
He said to me, I must go to school and re-estivicate Tinyana on media studies. Now I know where it comes from. But Doc, you know, getting into the actual work and the Border Management Authority, we know that the ATT or the Agency of Home Affairs was officially launched, I think, late 2022. And I've said earlier on, offset, I've noticed how political parties generally, even those opposing each other in South Africa, have rallied behind the BMA. So I think it gives a leeway. It creates an opportunity because then you've got the whole political support. I don't know. I may be misreading it, but you know, if you can take us through that on political interference, the support from various political parties, even before the formation of the GNU, that's just my observation. And I think for a person occupying an administrative leadership position in the civil service, it must be wonderful to work with the full political support.
Yeah, maybe the first thing to actually indicate is that, you know, conceptually, the formation and the establishment of the BMA is something that is actually appreciated, not just in South Africa, but actually even in the continent and the rest of the world. I mean, we already are getting a lot of invitations for people to, in a way, for people wanting us to come and share with them, how did we manage to actually do a structure of this nature? Mm. And the reason for that is fairly because if you look at the model itself, borders had always been deploying a multi-agency approach. Yes. And that has always been very much problematic. Even now, as we speak, most countries, as they struggle around issues of border management, is because of the multi-agency approach. You know, I was basically saying the other day that if you were to think about multi-agency approach and you think about other sectors, if it did make sense, why wouldn't they want to implement it in other places, in other ecosystems? And I want to give a practical example. Before we took over as the Border Management Authority on the 1st of April 2023, if you were to go to OR Tambo and say, I want to know who is in charge here, who's the boss, you're going to be confronted with seven different people.
Yes.
Who each one of them are actually a manager of OR Tambo in their own right. There was an OR Tambo manager responsible for immigration, OR Tambo manager responsible for agriculture, OR Tambo manager responsible for health, OR Tambo manager for customs, for police. So effectively, if you have that kind of an environment where people are all equal and all of them are managers and they are working with people below, it's a very difficult environment. Sure. And I'm saying, if that was to make sense, think about that being implemented in a school where you are to be confronted with something like 10 principals in one school.
Yes.
Where one will say, I'm the principal in this school just for English. I'm the principal in this school for agriculture. It will be a mess. How will that kind of school be run? It will be a mess. But that is exactly what borders had actually been managed. So it is on that basis that integrating all of these things and ultimately end up with a single commander for each port,
yes,
and ultimately have the various functions as functionalities becomes much of a model that is understood intellectually and people are able to appreciate it. It is for that reason where you now have everybody now understanding the model and they are starting to support it across the political divide.
At a human capital level, how do you then manage that change? Because some people will say, I've worked at this port of entry for the last 20, 30 years. This is all I know. All of a sudden, I must adjust to this change. How did you as a leader make sure that everyone buys into this is how we're now going to do things?
Yeah, you say fresh, that is a very interesting part. I mean, I spent 2022 after being appointed in 2021, but
yes,
2022 as well as the earlier part of 2023, I spent most of the time doing staff consultation,
sure,
throughout the entire country, wherein I had to sit down and tell the people that colleagues, nobody is going to be negatively affected. Nobody's job is going to be, you know, negatively affected. I had around 19 trade unions that one had to interact with and have to give them assurance and basically sell an idea that does not exist in, yes, a way, and tell them about us having to integrate the functions, but ultimately give them this principle that says, each one of yourselves, in terms of the work that you do on the ground, there is not going to be much of a difference. If you are an agricultural biosecurity expert, you are an environmental biosecurity expert, you are an environmental health practitioner for port health purposes, or you are an immigration officer, you are still going to remain as an immigration officer. The only issue here is the pyramid is no longer going to be open up there in a multi-agency context. Up there is going to be narrowed up and there's going to be a single command and control. But what it actually started to introduce, and I think that is where the biggest benefit and the people are able to see, is the fact that you are now going to do optimal utilization of resources.
Yes.
Because now, I mean, a typical example of what I'm talking about, if you were to have a meeting in Polokwane in Limpopo and you wanted officials coming from Bedbridge coming to Polokwane, you will literally have seven vehicles having to be driven from Beitbridge to Polokwane, each one of them with an individual for that specialization.
Imagine.
So you will have a car for immigration, which is Home Affairs, with one officer going to that meeting. You'll have another car for SARS with an officer from SARS driving there. You'll have another one for the police. You'll have another one for agriculture. And all of that. So that is a wasted of resources because they will be driving after each other because they can't get into each other's cars because there are protocols for that.
Yeah.
But now with the Border Management Authority, you have a single car. All of the officers, they belong to one authority, single command and control. They enter into the car and they go down to the meeting. So that is the kind of... So you start to optimize the environment and colleagues are able to interwork. In other words, they are able to support each other because they actually belong into the same platform. They are wearing the same uniform. They just actually wearing different insignia in terms of their specialization.
Okay.
There will be those that are wearing immigration insignia for the purposes of immigration work, those for agricultural biosecurity, environmental biosecurity, health, and also those for law enforcement. So all of those things, when people are starting to understand them, then they're able to start dealing with the issues. But one thing that we have done, Fresh, which is very critical, was to put together a very strong team to deal with issues of your organizational culture and make sure that we deal with the whole issue of a change so that colleagues are able to then be taken through the process and make sure that they understand the transition, they understand the new platform in the organization. You must remember, we are the third National Armed Law Enforcement Authority, and on that basis, people have to start wearing ranks and people have to start salutations.
Yes.
We have to train them also in terms of saluting and all of those things.
Now, Doc, on a follow-up question with that, And it's an unfair question from my side because of prior experience and information. And you have addressed the issue of integrating people at a junior level and officers. Did you experience any challenges because at the formation of the BMA initially, there was also a challenge at leadership level. The managers you mentioned, people did not want to let go of the positions. You can have one control and command. For example, I've noticed that the South African Police Service was not fully integrated, just like SARS Customs. And the South African Police Service were initially part of the formation. So I was asking myself, was it because of a rank or, you know, a challenge from the command and control kind of a situation? The police being a law enforcement entity, you just mentioned the three. For the benefit of our viewers and followers, let me mention that it is the armed forces of the country, the soldiers, then the South African Police Service, then the Border Management Authority. Those are the three. So was it because of the challenge in law enforcement or was it power politics on top?
Yeah, I think that one is a more difficult one. Maybe let me start with the customs one. The customs one, as part of legislating the Border Management Authority's establishment, was already clarified there to indicate that the customs function will remain outside the Border Management Authority control. And therefore, on that particular basis, we have to then be working with them, particularly the law enforcement aspect in the front end. So that actually has been cleared. It was part of the discussion during the lawmaking process, and that ultimately got resolved in that context. In terms of a unit called Border Police in SAPS, that one was meant to be integrated because it was just a unit that was doing border law enforcement. But of course, when that integration was supposed to happen, there were some bit of issues. And the issues were kind of intellectually understandable. And the issue is that the country itself, broadly speaking, comparing the number of police officers and the number of citizens, they are short. In other words, they are less in number. And on that basis, you wouldn't want to let them go and be integrated into the Border Management Authority. But instead, we just need to get the Border Management Authority capacitated to do border law enforcement so that those officers can then be integrated into the work inside the country.
Okay.
So that is what ultimately is the position. And that is why you will realize now, even in terms of the SONA articulation of the president, that there is now going to be a focus to capacitate the work of border law enforcement in particular, but broadly border management. That is going to start helping us to do exactly that transition, wherein we have to then, in a way, bring in the capacity into the space and then gradually then get the police to go and do the normal work in the country. Yeah, that's the essence.
Speaking capacity, Doc, How are we going to know that now we have enough men and women capacitated to do the job that needs to get done? Because unfortunately, the narrative for the last almost 30 years has been borders are porous, borders are porous. Because I use the borders a lot, I see the work you're doing. I see the boots on the ground. You were busy all of December. I don't even think your family saw you most of December because you're only busy at the border. When are we going to know that, okay, we have enough men and women, or we now have other people who come into the country illegally, knowing that there are consequences if you try and cross the border? Because obviously we need to strike the balance between they need to get the message, but how can we fail? Also, we still need men and women that we know will continue this work so that the narrative that the borders are porous can change. How are you striking the balance?
Yeah, maybe let me start by saying, Fresh, because this is very much fundamental. When we started, remember, we were to start the organization on the 1st of April, 2023. So I came in 2021. So 2021, I came in December. So the whole of 2022, part of what I had to do was to then go out there to do a study.
Yes.
Not necessarily anything thumbsucked, but something very scientific in terms of looking at the entire ecosystem. Remember, we work in 71 ports of entry. Out of the 71, 52 of them are land. 10 of them are international airports. 9 of them are seaports. So basically, it's 8 seaports, and the 9th one is a dry port, which is in city deep. Now, that is the ecosystem. But additional to that, we work in what is called the border law enforcement area. Border law enforcement area, as defined in the Border Management Authority Act, is 10 kilometers into the country from internationally recognized borderline. On the coast side, we do the same. It's 10 kilometers inland, but we also work 12 nautical miles into the sea to make sure that we deal with that particular environment. Now, when we did that particular study and we had to look at the work itself that we need to be doing, we came with a structure that needed around 11,200 people. And that 11,200 people were very much dissected in terms of how many are they going to be there for immigration work? How many are they going to be there for agricultural biosecurity? How many for environmental biosecurity? How many for port health? And how many for conventional law enforcement? The majority was going to be conventional law enforcement officers. We call them border guards.
Yes.
For the coast side, we call them coastal guards. Now it's 11,200. Now, in terms of the integration, we integrated around 1,200 people. I mean, 1,900 people. So it means 1,200 immigration officers, just around 400 were port health people, around 308 were agriculture people, and we had around 20 environmental biosecurity. We put them together, and then they actually became 1,900. That's the staff complement that we had integrated.
Yes.
Additional people we brought in was the 600 border guards plus the 50 coastal guard, which then bring us a staff complement of just around 2,600, which is why now we are saying, as the Border Management Authority, looking at what we need for us to do this work based on that scientific work I'm referring to, versus what we where we are now, we are operating at 25% capacity.
Yeah.
We are sitting at 75%, I'll say vacant rate.
Sure.
We are actually, like I say, 2,600, we are looking at over 8,000 plus people that must come and join us. So back to your question, we will know that we at least have the minimum base number of people we need for us to be able to do this work as instructed of us by law, only if we can get to the 11,200. Once we get there, then we will be able to start operating. And I want to give you a quick practical example on environmental biosecurity. So on environmental biosecurity work, we deal with the importation and exportation of what is called invasive species, endangered species, and all of those. Now, we don't even have presence in the critical ports where we are supposed to receive consignments. So if there's going to be, for example, a consignment of, let's say somebody is importing cobras from China, that is a specialized species, you can't bring them to any other port. We have certain ports where they can come. And then you find that they're bringing them via Cape Town International Airport. We have to fly our environmental biosecurity experts from here to go to Cape Town and go receive the consignment, do the processing before they allow them in. Now, normally, we are supposed to have people there to be able to do that work. But because we are undercapacitated, we have to fly people there. So once we get to at least 11,200, then we will start to know that we are now starting to be very much stable. But of course, the second part is the technology part,
sure,
which actually we can also talk to that one. The technology part is going to help us to augment the numbers for the purposes of better work with better data. And that was is going to be very critical.
Doc, let me just bring politics into that. And we'll come to the technology after, which I'm very impressed with the technology that you just adopted. The BMA, having been a priority of the state, whether it's political or for security or for service purposes, you know, for the BMA bill to be initiated and became an act and the formation, it was a state priority. What is it that is holding the capacitation of the entity, be it finance or be it a political will? Because if all role players agree that this is necessary, Fresh earlier on spoke about how everybody's talking about how our borders are porous, which I tend to differ with that. We can discuss it. I don't think our borders are porous. I've said it several times. And I want to say more, even it's more lack of capacity. Why there is no political will to capacitate such an important entity that we have been talking about for years? It's not 2 or 3 years. The first pronouncement of the BMA, if my memory serves me well, it was during the then ruling party ANC January 8th statement under President Zuma in 2010, if I'm not mistaken. And from that time until 2026, and the BMA is not fully capacitated. I don't expect it to be fully at 11,000, but why not at least at half of what we need as a count? Where is the bottleneck? What is holding us back?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, the first part, Mulwa, is I wouldn't necessarily talk to the political issues. As you will know, as a technocrat myself, I wouldn't talk to the political side. But what I can talk about is when we did that structure at the time, we then said that this particular work, just in the first year of operation, we had to cost it.
Yes.
And when we costed it, it was to cost the state 2.9 billion, meaning when you enter the financial year 2023 going forward into 2024 and then 2024-25, 25-26, which is a 3 year period,
yes,
we were going to be needing 2.9 billion. But ultimately what we got to understand to have been the issue was, unfortunately, the establishment of the BMA coincided with what is described as constrained fiscus.
Okay.
And that is why on the first year, we only were able to secure 250 million.
That's not even a fraction, a quarter of what we required.
So that was 8% of what we requested. And that was the genesis of the challenges. Therefore, what was the problem? What we understand to have been the problem was that it was the year which coincided with a constrained fiscus, and there were these things called budget cuts and all of those. And all of these things are public. So I think since then, we then started to struggle, because the next year, we then got 300 million, meaning you just add 50. And then the third year, we got 350. So it was 250, it was 300, it was 350.
So it's 50 million,
meaning 50 million additional, yeah, for the past 3 years. And that is where we are now. So where we are now is that, exactly as you said, when we go to Parliament, we present it to the Portfolio Committee on Home Affairs, to the Standing Committee on or Select Committee on Security and Justice. We present it to the Standing Committee on Appropriations and all of those. There is a unanimous agreement,
yes,
across the political divide that indeed this is a critical structure in the country, particularly understanding the impact of illegal migration, but more importantly, the impact of the movement of illicit goods into our country. So all of those impacts are clear. Everybody's able to see. Now, the issue was just the constrained fiscus. However, we are now going to the 2026-2027 financial year. And that is why I suppose everybody is waiting in anticipation for the budget speech of the 25th of Feb. And that is where we are going to be able to hear if there will be any traction. But from where I sit, everybody I talk to is supporting. Everybody one talks to is agreeing that there must be capacitation. And I suppose what has been the constraint has purely been more quantitative, which is purely financial. And I suppose this year we might see some change.
We're holding thumbs. When you do hire, are you looking for people with certain border management experience already or law enforcement experience, or do you hire from scratch and train from scratch?
Yeah. So one of the fundamentals was in 2022, when we brought the first contingents of the border guards, which was the 200 that we had to bring. I remember I was with Dr. Aaron Motsoaledi, and you know, the minister was
he's my favorite doctor, in fact.
So what he basically said was, Commissioner, we have no time. Yes. We need to move. I need boots on the ground. So on that basis, we wouldn't have time to recruit from the scratch.
Yes.
And what we did was just a basic advert out. I remember at the time, we wanted 200 people just to come in as border guards. Mm. And we got 14,800 applications.
Wow.
And these were people where we wanted people who are already trained in law enforcement, people who have some bit of training in terms of handling firearms and all of that. So these are people who were applying already operating in the system, whether they were police, they were military, they were correctional services, they were security guards. And out of that, we took the 200.
Mm.
When we had to do in 2023, the 400 additional, we then said, no, now there's no more agency, not agency per se, but there's no more pressure as it was in 2022.
Yes.
We then need to also contribute in the bringing in of the young ones.
Yes.
And also the employment, kind of contribute in the unemployment issue. Mm. And that is why that one, we said, no, this one we do normal recruitment. And then we said 18 to 35, as is always the tradition.
Mm.
And in there, we basically just said, you don't have to have any experience. So it was basically matriculants. Some people had some bit of degrees. We recruited your 19-year-olds. I mean, your 20-year-olds, 21-year-olds, 22-year-olds. And then we took them to training for 9 months.
Mm.
We partnered with the RTMC, the Road Transport Management Corporation. We put them into the academy in Captain Park. And we trained them for 9 months. And after that, we enrolled them.
Mm.
So after enrolling them, obviously, we had to then start to get them deployed on the ground. And then they start working, and now they are. So once we get money, even now, because our agenda is also to contribute in the unemployment spectrum, it is going to be the same. We're going to ask for the younger ones and bring them on the value chain and be able to move. Yeah.
One still on that point, one of the biggest fears in recruitment for the Border Management Authority has always been contaminated officials.
Mm-hmm.
And how did the entity handle the cross, you know, transfer? For example, earlier on, Fred spoke about the same faces everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And we have seen a few cases in the media reports about BMA officials who have been caught, you know, doing unbecoming things. How did you handle that? Because if we are still going to recruit within the same people, let me use an example, former border police, they may contaminate the new ones, or they may continue with their modus operandi of the past. Mm. Just you know, on that, in order to try and figure out how is it handled. But I think fresh...
No, so, in fact, I wanted to add, because I was saying to the good doctor earlier on that one thing I've appreciated is the borders that I use frequently, whether it's into Swaziland, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, or Botswana. I'm seeing different faces.
Mm.
So clearly you're rotating to reduce familiarity. Because obviously familiarity breeds botolt.
Definitely. Yeah, maybe let me start here, on the issue of dealing with that aspect. Section 13, subsection 3 of the Border Management Authority gives us something that the rest of the other departments did not have. And that is the power to vet the officers that comes through into the Border Management Authority. So that is one thing that is very much fundamental. And by the way, because that is a legislated activity, we have no issues. The only thing is we actually are dependent on the state security agents to do the actual vetting, because the law did not give us a power to do it by ourselves. So we do it with state security. So that already had started to assist us in terms of making sure that the people we bring on board are people that are already properly, in a way, that are grounded in a way.
Okay.
But now, when we did the actual integration, because we were integrating people in mass, I mean, you can imagine almost just below 2,000 people, we couldn't necessarily do a pre, but we had to do once they are already in.
Inside, okay.
And when we were doing that, we were saying in extreme cases where we really find people that are extremely, cannot actually be embraced, we will then have a guarantee that nobody's going to lose their job. We are then going to do a process to have those people actually integrated back into the mother department, as we call it. Okay. So that is a guarantee that we have to give even to labor to make sure that we don't use this process, because this is a clearly a Section 197 process of Labor Relations Act, and you need to give guarantees and all of those issues. So all of those things were done. However, the ones that we appoint, they go through that very intensive process.
Okay.
Now, the other things that we do, by the way, we created what is called the Border Management and Immigration Anti-Corruption Forum. Mm. That is actually being chaired by the head of the Special Investigating Unit. It has been Advocate Mutibi for all this while. Now it is Leonard Lekgetho who's actually chairing it. So what do? We go to all these ports. And we go have sessions there and actually tell people about the dangers of being involved in corrupt activities. We are trying to be proactive. But what do we do, which is something very much new, I had to engage with the Commissioner of Correctional Services, Commissioner Tobahal, and say, can you please bring us some of the women and men that are serving in prison that used to work in the ports that were caught doing corrupt activities, and those people got arrested, and as we speak, they are saving time.
Scary tactics. You can reverse psychology.
Definitely. So what do? We take those people, we go into the port, we call the officials, and we basically start there. We have everybody. We have the OCS, we have the ID, Investigative Directorate of the NPA. We literally have the SIU there. We have everybody, and we say, colleagues, it does not give anybody pleasure to be signing letters of firing people,
yes,
but also getting people into prison. It doesn't give anybody pleasure. Mm. What we need to do is to understand the work we do, the criticality of it, the fact that we have to preserve the country's national security. We must protect our own national interest. If you actually go take 20 rand from an illegal person who comes here and kill people and do all sorts of things, it is not even in your own interest. So we talk like that.
Okay.
Then you will have a young girl, for example, a young woman who will come and say, guys, I also used to work here in this port. I was an immigration officer, but I was caught taking 20 rand from an illegal person. And I was actually caught on camera. As we speak now, I'm serving 5 years in prison. I've lost everything.
Mm.
So it sounds like a bit of a threatening technique, but we call it a proactive approach.
Proactive approach.
And by the way, we are going to, now on the 10th of March, we are going to Maseru Bridge.
Okay.
Under the same context, we had a big marquee there. We bring everybody in, and these guys, they come even with their uniform. You know, the
correctional service,
the orange overall.
Definitely. Yes. And that for us, it helped us to try and change people's mentality.
Mm.
Those are the proactive ones, except the technology aspect that will reflect on.
That was going to be my next question to say, I've seen just before December when you were doing the border, the festive planning process, that some of the ports, particularly Bait Bridge and along the borderline, you have introduced drones. That actually, the reports that came up is that they assisted both the border guards and the military in detection of illegal trade, moving of goods, and even human movement. And my question has been, with those drones being there, how many, why are we not extending it to all the ports? I know the cost will be the first question, but also the scanners at ports, it's part of technology, good scanners, and the body cams, the technology, you know, when you look at the model we adopted, the Canadian, all border guards wear body cams, and we copied that process as a country. Where are we with that? Well, despite the financial struggles, I think me and Fresh, we must invite Minister Godongwana to come and explain to us why if everybody agrees, are they not giving BMA money? But the technology part.
Yeah, so if we can talk on the technology part, let me indicate. You see, in as much as we talk about border management issues, as we speak now, you know, as South Africa, the solutions are there. That one I can assure you. I mean, one has been exposed into a number of countries and what other like countries are doing out there. I mean, for me, the solutions is not even something that we have to even worry about, because they are actually there. The only issue is investment into it. So what happened in 2023? Immediately we realized that we were not able to get some bit of, adequate allocation into the ecosystem. We then applied into CARA, the Criminal Asset Recovery Account. This is the account that is managed by the Department of Justice and that actually puts in money that gets recovered from criminal activities where there is no direct victim. So they bring it into the CARA fund. So as the law enforcement authorities, we are allowed to apply to use that money for the same law enforcement work.
Okay.
That is what Karaman is about. So we applied at the time. We said 500 million is what we will need, because at least we'll be able to buy the tools of trade, but also move into technology and all of that. But out of the 500 million we applied for, we were able to get 150 million. So we took 150, we said we are going to do the basic stuff. So what we did, among the rest of the other things we bought, including firearms, ammunitions, we bought drones, and then we bought the body cams. So how many? We're only able to afford 4 drones. That's what we have. 4 drones.
Private sector, I said, don't need this drone, Omar.
I'll come to the issue of the drone. I'll come to the issue of the donation. So we have 4 drones, yeah, and then we have 40 body cams.
Sure.
So what we do is we deploy the drones on the basis of the risk modeling that we use. So we look at which ports are giving us the most problems, whether in terms of the numbers of illegal migrants or the numbers of goods that comes through and all of that. So Bait Bridge is always one of those. Lebombo to Mozambique is one of those. Bit of Maseru Bridge and all of that. So we move them across those places. And I can assure you, they have actually been very helpful, especially the drones.
Okay.
What has been the biggest advantage of the drones? Instead of having officers patrolling the entire border, busy burning gasoil and diesel and petrol all the time, we no longer do that. So what you put the drone up on the sky. Oh, by the way, we trained our own border guards. They are now what you will call drone pilots.
Ah, yes.
So they are operating 24 hours. Mm. So what do? They put the drone on air and then they monitor the space. Then we actually put together response teams.
Okay.
So response teams are no longer just driving around, but they actually get stationed in strategic places. And then they also have the body cams that also serve as a communication device. And on that basis, we are able to interface back to them and say, we can see there are 2 guys, they've just crossed now, they're coming through. Mm. Because remember, in terms of the borderline, as you will know, there will be an international borderline. There will be what is called no man's land.
Yes.
And they will be entering into South Africa. If people are still in between, you can't do much.
Yes.
Until they get to your space. And that is how we then hit. And that is how we do the interception. Mm. The most important part, we are able to then intercept what you will call facilitators. When we intercept facilitators, we don't deport them. We make sure we take them to police station and get them to the police station and get them to be processed. Just quickly, fresh on your question about, or your issue about Earth donation.
Sector. Yes.
So the donation aspect is a very complex one.
Mm.
And the complexity comes in this way. If it is a donation that is to come from a private enterprise whose business is drones,
yes,
automatically, if we are to receive a donation from that enterprise, it will bring a conflict of interest. When we now want to buy the drones and we do a tender, and the same company then goes and tender it.
Yes.
Because they are already in the advantage. Because one of the motivations they will give is that, oh, by the way, these guys are already using our drones.
Tried and tested.
And they are already, in a way, in a system of that particular drone.
Mm.
Automatically, for the other role players, it will be seen as an advantage.
Mm.
So that is why, because of the complexities of the supply chain, it is not allowed. However, we can receive a donation from other, lack of a better word, government structures.
Mm.
And I want to give an example. Although I say we have 4 drones, we have just received the 5th drone donated by the KZN government, which is the provincial government.
Yes.
Premier Ntuli actually facilitated that process and we got it. We are going to deploy it in Northern KZN. So we can receive drones, but it depends from who. We can receive it from a business.
If private citizens are keen to donate, are those welcome to donate?
No, definitely.
Yes.
If it's a private individual who is not going to have any conflict of interest,
yes,
and who is in a business, in other words, who can be a potential contender for a business activity in the BMA, then that's not an issue.
So if I have nothing to gain and I'm about king and country and I want to donate,
yeah,
by all means, I can.
No, definitely you can. But there are processes to do.
Yeah.
Okay.
What I was thinking about on private sector donations, and it's a model that, you know, me and you, Fresh, we talked about it quite a lot. And I know the formation of the BMA, it was on the table. With understanding of the conflict of interest and the security part, because the government doesn't also want to be infiltrated by private sector.
Mm.
But what I was thinking, it's a situation where there are businesses that are losing on income and revenue due to illicit trade.
Definitely.
For example, we know one of our biggest challenges as a country is counterfeit goods, whether it's clothing or cigarettes. Now, I'm thinking of a situation, I'm just thinking outside the box, a situation whereby a cigarette company or a clothing company, any brand, says we are losing on revenue because of illicit goods. And openly, without any favor from government, we want to aid the BMA to say, as a company, we have picked up that most of our illicit clothing goods, they come via the port of Cape Town, or most of the cigarettes, they come via Bay Bridge, which is the land port to Zimbabwe. We want to contribute towards security, whether as drones, without doing business with government. That is the kind of, is that acceptable, or can the government is open to can consider that as well? Because what it will do, it will enhance security for the country, but it will protect the business interest of that particular, you know, a business person.
Yeah, you see, Mula, let's answer this one and say, Section 5, Subsection C of the BMA talks to that. It says, as you do this work, because of the complexity of it, and the complexity of the ecosystem, you must be able to interface, collaborate, coordinate with one, principal organs of state. It also says we must do that with the private enterprises. In other words, private individuals, as well as communities that are in the border environment, as an example. So that will definitely be accepted. And I want to give an example. There is this enterprise called Business Against Crime. We are partnering with Business Against Crime. So Business Against Crime is not a company. It is actually a group that will have various companies. So we basically can even deal with associations. And I want to give another practical example. We do have a group called South African Freight Forwarders Association.
Yes.
It's an association that oversees the trucking companies that do all these kind of activities. We work with them and they give certain donations, they give certain assistance and all of those. Now, for example, we are engaging with what is called the South African Meat Importers and Exporters Association. Inside them, there are companies. They are helping us even in terms of capacity as we speak. At Durban Harbour, for example, in terms of the processing of consignments, all these things are allowed. The only issue is you can't have a drone company donating a drone. Because that drone company, when we go to the market looking for a drone, they will want to tender. But if you are a tobacco company, like let's say British American Tobacco, we had a lot of conversations with them. They told us that 75% of the cigarettes smoked in South Africa is illicit. Only 25% is licit. They actually told us 2 years ago that if we don't do much and close the movement of illicit tobacco into the country, they're going to close shop. That was 2 years ago. We did our best. We stopped illicit cigarette almost to a value of R1 billion coming from our northern border. So all of these things are the efforts we have done. And then they basically said, unfortunately, we have tried our best and that's why now they're closing.
They're closing.
But if they were to say, we can actually buy you some 2 drones as British American Tobacco, it's not an issue because they are not a drone company. And that is the issue.
Sure.
And I think they should have invested in that to save their businesses. You know, absolutely. Participate in the process.
Dr. Masia Pato, this past December you were busy. And we all know that come December, Basotho go home, Batho ba Mozambique go home, Zimbabweans go home. There's mine workers going as far as Malawi, Botswana. What role does regional diplomacy play in helping to curb some of these inflows of people, especially the illegal inflow of people? Because at some stage, surely pick up the phone and say, Zimbabwe, why let's say you miss about to you know what I mean?
And
you know, I was reading a post on social media, someone talking about the fact that it's not in their interest to stop their people from coming here because their people are sending money back home.
Yeah.
So at a regional diplomacy level, how do we deal with this? Because I almost feel like it's the elephant in the room that no one is willing to start eating.
Yeah, you see, Fresh, I think that is the core.
Yes.
Particularly when we talk about illegal migration.
Mm.
So that is the core. But let me tell you the part that is working and the part that is not working. So the part that is working is when you talk about the facilitation of the legitimate people. Because that is the positive side. And that is what is embedded in the BMA Act.
Yes.
You know, Section 5A says facilitate people movement. And obviously B says facilitate goods movement. So when we talk to Botswana, or when we talk to Mozambique, or we talk to Zimbabwe, or Lesotho, and we talk about how do we facilitate people movement better, we talk well, we collaborate well, and everything moves. That is why if you go to now on the N17 into Eswatini Oshoek, we're able to reduce, working with SARS, you know, the trucks waiting time from 3 hours to 20 minutes.
That's amazing.
End to end.
Yes.
You know, from South Africa into Botswana, a truck is gone within 20 minutes from 3 hours. So those are the things that we do. We do time release study together. We analyze what are the bottlenecks in the processing. So all of those things, that is why now as we speak, there has been more efficiencies brought in both sides. Hence, we're also going to implement the one-stop border post where we are going to co-locate with them in one place, process people for exit and entry one place. All those things work well.
One-stop will be a game changer.
Yeah, no, definitely, yeah. Definitely. So we are definitely going to be implementing that. We're just finalizing, obviously, the redesigning of the ports, you know, the top six land ports that we are going to redesign. So that is not a problem. But once you touch illegal migration, then everything changes. And the reason why everything changes is exactly what you are saying. So when people are here, whatever they send back is part of Forex. You know, it's foreign currency going back to the jurisdiction.
Unofficially.
Yeah, definitely. And that also sustains the economies in the particular spaces.
Yes.
So that is more complicated beyond where I sit. It is more sitting at the higher level, which is more a bit political, wherein your departments now must then go engage their departmental counterparts, but also DERCO has to then be elevating the conversations at that level. However, you know that they are what we call BNCs, binational commissions, that are chaired at the presidential level. So those issues are mainly touched, but they get touched at the diplomatic level.
Oh, yes.
Not necessarily at the hardcore, but at the diplomatic. So it's more like being diplomatic about it and we pass. Diplomatic about it. So that is how the issue is. And I don't think it is something that we can easily resolve.
Yes.
How do people say we must resolve it? I always say, but that is a very nice way of saying it, but it's a very much impossible way. They say, we need, as South Africa, to stop ourselves to be a pull country, is to go invest in those countries and make sure that people get jobs in those countries so that people would not necessarily want to come here. But the same South Africa in itself, there are people from rural areas who are doing the same migration, which is internal.
Exactly.
So you can't easily think that it will be easy for South Africa to go do jobs or create jobs in somewhere else whilst they don't even have enough here. So I think those are the challenges.
But your counterpart in those countries,
yes.
You can't call them and say, how counterpart, what's going on?
No, I talked to them. Oh, by the way, maybe let me also say this. I was talking to one of my colleagues at Eswatini, Udadi Dlamini, and he was telling me, not even now, but in 2024 December, into January, and he was saying, but Commissioner, what have you started doing there in South Africa? I said, what do you mean? He said, I see now there is serious queue here in Home Affairs, here in Bhabane, people wanting to apply for passports.
Down to legitimize, you know? The crossing.
I said, but that's exactly what we need.
Yes.
You know, so people are starting to move into compliance, more and more people. And I got the same from Lesotho, by the way. And also there was some indication in Zimbabwe that more and more people are now trying to get themselves formalized. And I think people can really see. Because you see, the problem in South Africa was people were walking into the country with impunity.
Yes.
To the extent that even if they can get passports, they were never caring much. They will literally say, no, but what is the use?
Yeah.
I don't need to, because people walk in. And I want to give a practical example, Fresh, you will remember. Just to give a typical example of a shift. If you were to think, let's say 2022 backwards or 2023 before we came on board, there will be buses that will be intercepted on the N1, you know, coming from Bait Bridge. And you will find that a bus that is saving 60 people, when they intercept it, whether it's the traffic officers or the police, they stop the bus and they ask for passports. You will find that out of the 60 people, there will be something like around 50, passports, only 10. That was an occurrence of every weekend.
Yes.
You ask yourself, what happened? Why are those incidences disappearing? It is because of the impact that we are starting to have. And how does that happen? So what used to happen before, particularly even before the drones, is that the bus will come on the Zim side, it stops. When it stops that side, people without passports, they get told, guys, those without passport, get out and get to the bush. So they get out of the bus, they go to the bush. Only those people with passports, maybe there are 10 in this example, they are the ones who come inside the port, 10 of them with passports. The driver has passport. The bus had a cross-border permit. Everything complies. We then process the 10 people together with the bus, together with the driver, and then they drive into South Africa. Mm. When they're in South Africa, those people will then run out of the bushes into the same bus.
Yes.
And then the bus hits the N1, and then it comes through into South Africa. That is why that was the case.
Sure.
But now, what do? We put the drone on air. The powerful part of the drone is that it is able to give us activities in the neighboring side.
Oh, yes.
So we're able to see every bus, and we then monitor every bus. Yes. Which is why what I did, Mwilo will know because it came from the ecosystem. We called through the cross-border road transport agency, and we said, you call these people, that these bus companies that you are interfacing with in terms of cross-border permit, and say to them, they bring them, and then we tell them, if we find people in your bus without documents, number one, we are going to make sure that your driver is arrested. We are going to charge him or her for aiding and abetting according to the Immigration Act. But secondly, we are also going to make sure that your bus is impounded.
They hated me for that because I brought that concept in, was not yet implemented, to say, in order to squeeze people who are committing crime, must squeeze their business, impound the vehicle.
Yeah.
And I was not liked for that. So when I saw you implementing it, I was very happy.
No, we implemented it and now they are complying. And the only people that we need to deal with is the taxi guy.
I was going to say, because there's big business in ferrying people who are undocumented in and out of Zim, for argument's sake. There are even services that will take your child across during the holidays and bring them back.
Without parental act, being accompanied my parent.
Your parent, it's wild. Yeah.
But, you know, let me flip the coin and throw the spanner in the works regarding the operational challenges WorkFresh has. And you have explained it very well to us and the viewers and the followers of the podcast. But I want to look at the situation without looking at the other country, what they are doing. Because we can't force them. We can't control them.
Yeah.
We can engage them diplomatically. As Fresh said, sometimes it is to their benefit that we are struggling with illegal migrants. But I want to look at our internal laws. And I know it is not, you are the agents of Home Affairs and you will not talk to the police. Like now, there's a new immigration or citizenship, it's called the citizenship bill, that is before Parliament. They closed last week, Sunday. What are the challenges that the BMA as an operational entity facing regarding the laws of the country, starting from the constitution, human rights, immigration act, that you implement part of it or enforce part of it, but also you look at the human rights part. And I'm asking this or bringing this up, remembering the situation we had with the 25 Afghans, just one of them, that few years back they landed at Bay Bridge. We didn't know how they came, by obviously by land. But how did they end up in Zimbabwe? We heard they were from Zambia, but they're Afghans. And NGOs in the country ran to court to force the government to allow those 25 Afghans. We don't know if they were 25. How is it difficult? And what is the role of the BMA in trying and fighting those kind of challenges? And like I said at the beginning, talk, it may not be in your space as an operational person, but I'm owning up as a country to say we have laws, NGOs and challenges that we create, and people run to courts or NGOs. How are you navigating between that?
So I'll talk to that, Mulo, just a second. But I just wanted to firstly clear the issue that Fresh has raised about the enterprise part.
Yes.
Particularly the movement of children in between jurisdictions. Yes, indeed, it has been a very lucrative enterprise. But the good thing is, we have actually started dealing with that aspect. In 2023, 3rd of December, if you remember, we intercepted 43 buses.
Yes.
Out of the 43, we had over 430 children that were actually ferried into the country without any document at all.
Yeah.
We dealt with that situation and those children were taken back to Zim on the spot. And you remember even the media attention that issue had and ultimately. But since then, things started to go down. So 2024, there were no issues. But now 2025 in December, we started to see the issue resurfacing, where we had around 53, all in Bay Bridge that we had to intercept. We then called the Zimbabweans, we sit down with them. We said, guys, we cannot allow this. Because remember, once you are seen as a country that is not serious about the movement of children between countries, even globally, it becomes a problem.
It's a trafficking issue.
Yeah, it's a trafficking issue. So we dealt with that aspect. And from where I'm sitting now, is actually under control. But we know it is very lucrative. Back to Mwilo's point. So, number one, there is a very general understanding in South Africa that our immigration laws, as we stand, are very problematic. If you look at the Immigration Act of 2002, it is clear that what we basically did, and I think this is normal, it's known, you know, to say that we went to the UN conventions, UN laws, we translated most of their write-up and we made them into the laws of South Africa, and that is why they are very much problematic. Secondly, the issue of Citizenship Act itself, very much problematic in the country, and that is why people had been literally receiving citizenship on the basis of marriage and all of those kind of issues, which has been very problematic. Hence, the issues around the fake marriages. Then the issue of refugee protection, a lot of other loopholes in terms of all those issues. It is for that reason why, as we speak now, there is a white paper on international migration, citizenship and refugee protection. That white paper, as we speak now, it is being circulated throughout South Africa. The intention by the Department of Home Affairs, because they are the policy department, is to engage South Africa for the intention of changing all the three pieces of legislation. Refugee Act, Immigration Act, as well as Citizenship Act.
Sure.
So that we can have a single piece of legislation that regulates the three as one document. That is going to assist us to close the loopholes that we are referring to. So that has indeed been one of the fundamentals. And I want to give a very quick practical example fresh, because that is the biggest problem. If somebody arrives, which is exactly the Afghan example, if somebody arrives at the port and they say, I'm an asylum seeker. So what do? We give them a Section 23 permit according to the Immigration Act. Section 23 permit says, we are giving you this permit to enter South Africa without any document. You don't even have to have a passport.
Yes.
You enter South Africa with Section 23 permit. Then we say, you can go to any refugee reception center anywhere in the country. So in Pretoria, here in Gauteng, you can go to Maravastat there for that refugee reception center called Desmond Tutu. And there will be another one in Cape Town, Durban, and all of those places. So now somebody has gained access into the country, given 5 days to go to the refugee reception center to go and apply. So what people do, they enter the country and they don't care about going there.
No.
And that is why we have a lot of people in the country illegal. So we have given them access, which is legal, which is why to deal with that, this particular white paper proposes that we must close these refugee reception centers inside the country, take them to the port.
Sure.
If somebody arrives at the port and say, I want to apply for asylum in South Africa, we say, go to that office.
At the port.
At the port.
Yes.
And you go apply there. If you apply and you are rejected, we say you have an option to appeal.
Sure.
When you start drafting your appeal, we say that is the appeal office.
Absolutely.
At the port.
Absolutely.
Once your appeal is kicked out, then you have to go back. And that is how we are going to start dealing with some of these issues. And that's the reality.
Because surely national security should be way more important than humanitarian obligations and constitutional obligations. But for some reason, you know, and more often than not, you know, the NGOs use the constitution against national security.
In my comments, I've said, Doc, they are running a parallel government. But would I be unfair to come to a conclusion or comment that most of the immigration problems we are faced with in the country are based on our human rights and humanitarian reasons, not because of lack of security or porous borders? Because that has been my argument, to say it is our humanitarian position of the constitution. Because the rules of immigration and people coming in are very clear, but then they get cancelled by our own law. So we created our own problem. I actually woke me up, and when you explain how our immigration laws were formed, we copied the so-called UN laws that are mainly for humanitarian purposes and made them laws that are supposed to be law enforced. And that could be the challenge. But the last comment, I don't know if I'm unfair by, you know, concluding to that, but the other challenge I'm having it with, and I had a conversation with because I made one of the comments to the white paper with the Minister of Justice, to say one of the things I'm not comfortable with, and I spoke to people on the ground, it's reducing these three pieces of legislation into one. As a South African and a noble or, you know, lay citizen, I don't think it is just and fair, and I know it's not your responsibility to can have a Citizenship Act that puts a South African-born natural person on the same piece of legislation, one, with somebody who has sought asylum, with somebody who has immigrated here legally, who has followed process. I still do not understand where I'm sitting, both as a civil servant and as a citizen. why do we arrive at a point where we combine all these three laws into one? Yes, there'll be subsections, but why should I be governed by a law that governs somebody who immigrated here? And it's my opinion, you can critique me on that. I think it's unjust for South Africans to be classified into one. I would have preferred a situation whereby maybe asylum seekers and immigrants are in one, regulated by one law, and we as citizens who are born in natural here, we have our own citizen. Yeah. That's my view, but I've put a paper on that. I've put a submission. The closing date was last week, Sunday. And for me, that's I mean, other countries are doing that. Why do you want to reduce to one? I don't want to comment on what the Minister of Justice said to me, why is this happening? But she gave me a reason and said, no, we are tired of these NGOs, but I don't want to comment to that. But I don't know what's your view on that.
You see, I think we know on that particular aspect, what has been identified to be one of the challenges was the fact that we had three different pieces of legislation standing, you know, in other words, standing away from each other, but not properly coordinated in terms of the various pieces that are actually in them. And that is where the problem was. And the reason why that was basically the case, like I'm saying, is that when we were doing all these laws at that time, these were never priorities. In other words, when I say priorities, they were never built with national security thinking. They were just built with the fact that we are a democracy, we are a new country, and therefore people have the freedom to do whatever and all of those. That is why even issues of illegal migration was never thought. You must remember, illegal migration in South Africa was thought in 2008, immediately after Zim started having challenges. That is when we started to say, but what is happening? And that is where the Zimbabwean exemption permit comes from.
Yes.
Because when they came in large numbers, we got to wake up to realize that our immigration system is not able to handle that situation. Hence, we did the exemption permit. And now we are trying to deal with the issues of around how do we kind of, you know, start to slow it down and close it, which is a difficult. Now, back to the issue of saying, why do we have to bring them together? The issue of bringing them together was to make sure that the sections that are sitting in all the three are talking to each other and there are no contradictions. That was the pure part. In any event, the section that talks about South Africans from a citizenship point of view is not supposed to be a lot. Because if you are a South African, you are born from a South African parent in terms of mother and a father, what more else does it need to be defined about you? So there's nothing much except to say, what are the fundamentals that must be fulfilled if somebody from outside wants to be a citizen in South Africa? That is what that law is all about. So the majority of the sections are about that. But for the South African side, there is nothing much to write about, because in any event, when you are South African, you are a South African, and it is implied you are going to be in our national population register. But like you're saying, it is something that can be looked further. It can still be split, but the objective was to make sure that there is alignment among the three and there is no any abuse of one against the other. Because as we speak now, there is no case that you can win according to the way this the current laws. You can't win, because they go and quote Immigration Act. And then when you think that you are getting somewhere, then they go quote Citizenship Act, and you get to realize that, hey, no, they have a point. When you think you have something, they go and quote Refugee Protection. Asylum Act. So if you look at Refugee Act, so if you look at all of those things done, then they make legislative environment in these three things that are interrelated too difficult to implement. And that is why they said, let's reduce this into a single piece which will regulate all the three and make sure that there is no any confusion, but there is coherence in state.
Okay. Minister Mamoloko will like the way you put it, because it was giving a lot of hate. But what I wanted to say on a lighter note earlier, because we have been talking, myself and Fresh, more and more about this, to say, why are these NGOs winning in court? I've been explaining this to people for many years, the law does not. The problem is our laws. And the immigrants are taking advantage of that. But he always says, we were Madiba fight. You know, at that time, so we just welcome and we saw everybody as a friend, and all that. And that's the danger of writing and making laws when you are intoxicated, not by alcohol in this time, but by the circumstances and the environment we are operating
on. That's the conversation we had with Ibrahim and Mashaba when he was lamenting what's happening with In fact, what was he complaining about? He was complaining about the Constitution.
The preamble of the Constitution.
And I had to remind him that at the time, nobody anticipated that
all of this,
that there'd be an influx of people.
Yes.
So you can't hold it against the forefathers of a democratic South Africa that you wanted everyone to come here. You know?
Yeah, I mean, maybe just a quick one on the basis of what you've just said. And Minister Motsoaledi always used to quote this. In the Immigration Act, just that I can't remember the section, it basically says that nobody can be refused from entering South Africa.
Yes.
Explicitly, literally, explicitly written there. So and that particular section does not have unless. It just stops there. So effectively, with those
asylum seekers,
no, those ones in
Afghans,
yes. When they arrive at Bedbridge, minister will tell you that I just had to do dust. Literally, I had just to put dust and make noise, and that is how they did not come in. But legally, there was no way that they were going to be refused, and that is why they had to be thrown with dust quick before even the court issue was going to be activated.
Does this mean you're not ready for a political career?
I wanted to say earlier on, he speaks more like a politician these days.
Now, Dr. Masia Pato, let's talk about the Section 22 Asylum Seeker Temporary Permit.
Yeah, definitely.
Under what circumstances can it be revoked? Let me tell you why I'm asking.
Yeah.
You have people who come into the country seeking asylum.
Yeah.
They apply for the Section 22. They get the Section 22.
Yeah.
And Dr. Motsoaledi even lamented this himself.
Yeah.
But in December, they go home for Christmas. Yeah. What kind of asylum do you need that's temporary? But you can still go back home where you tell us you've been persecuted.
Yeah.
But get December home, not to go high.
Yeah.
Like, how does that make sense?
Yeah. Just to add on that, maybe you can combine it into a single answer. Also, in addition to that, the normal or common international practice is that asylum seekers will seek asylum in an immediate neighboring country.
Yeah.
But we have found ourselves in South Africa, we've got asylum seekers from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Somalia, which when we are not the immediate neighboring country.
Yeah.
What is the situation there? Just to add on what Fresh is asking.
On that part. Maybe let me start with this and I'll come to your part, Fresh. You see, Mwela, on that particular aspect, I think one thing that we need to agree on is the fact that the issue of a first country principle, if you do not legislate and you clarify it, it does not actually bind.
Exactly.
I was talking to the one of the commissioners from the UNHCR, United Nations High Commission for Refugees, and she was basically putting it very clear. She says, if you say you need to implement a first country, it's just a principle.
Remember,
the first country rule or first country principle, it is a rule that is... So it's more like the preferred reality. But if on your side you do not actually legislate to say this is what is to be the case, it's not going to apply. Remember, in Home Affairs, we have what is called RSDOs, Refugee Status Determination Officers. Part of what they use as a criteria to determine if somebody qualifies to be given a refugee status in the country is not the issue of first country. They don't even have that in because our law does not actually prescribe for it. That is why now in the white paper, that is something that is amplified to be able to be put in. Once it is put in, then when the RSDOs are making a determination, the first thing they will say, where do you come from? You say, I'm from Bangladesh. To say, why didn't you go to
India,
for example. So automatically it means those people would not even come because we would have legislated to activate that particular principle. But now we don't have that. And that is where the problem is. Now, coming back to Fresh's issue about the people we are dealing with, let me say this. The people that we are dealing with, which is the majority in this instance, they are not refugees. They are economic migrants. This is the people we are dealing with. If you talk about conventional refugees, obviously there is a non-refoulement principle. You cannot go into a country you ran away from. You can't do that. And secondly, the movement of refugees is also regulated by a country that has given you a status.
Sure.
So if you have to go back to your country, it will be on a particular condition and it will be for a particular period. And that particular country where you are, because they have a responsibility to protect you, they will also have to have the details. Most of the time, people will have to go back. Maybe they want to go and sneak in to bury their mother and quickly come back.
Sure.
It is that kind of a situation. So that is where refugees move. But here, we are not talking about refugees. Here, we talk about economic migrants.
Okay.
Where is the genesis of our problem, particularly around us in terms of South Africa and SADC, you will know there is something that we call 90-day free entry visa into South Africa.
Yes.
So, and I know this is a fundamental point, Fresh and Mwila, because this is key. And I know it's the center of our issues and we don't want to deal with it. Is the fact that the 90 days that is given to people from around SADC to enter South Africa and for South Africa to enter another country and the rest of others to enter each other for 90 days.
Mm.
It is 90 days per annum. It's not 90 days per visit. So what?
So why does the system not flag it though?
I want to come to that and say that is what is being abused.
Okay.
By the way, you are also a beneficiary of the same 90 days.
Absolutely.
That is why if you go to Botswana, they will not tell you, but they know on the system they are busy minusing the 90 days.
Okay.
So if you go to, and 90 days is counted per your visit according to the date you entered.
Yes.
So meaning that if you enter today is the 19th of February, 2026, it means your 90 days, I mean, your year is going to end next year by the same date.
Mm.
So if you go to Botswana for 3 days, so they say 3 days you've been in. When you exit, they minus from the 90 days.
Oh, so the system is ticking.
Yeah, it's ticking to say you have 87 left.
Okay.
If you go again for holiday in June with your family and then you go in there, and then you add another person, for example, whenever they will minus, let's say you go for 5 days, you are left with 87. So they are going to say, now you have 82.
Sure.
They minus. The other person is only 5, then it's going to be now you are left with 85.
Mm.
So it's personalized and it's as per the system.
Okay.
And that is where the counting is. And then, for example, let's say next year, 19th of Feb arrives, and you are still having, let's say, 70 days. It doesn't matter. That 70 days falls off and you get another 90.
Oh, okay. So it doesn't roll over.
It doesn't roll over. So that is how it is supposed to. That is what has been agreed in SADC.
Yes.
But guess what happens? Mm. And that's where the abuse is. Now, people are now converting the 90 days. No longer as 90 days per annum, they make it 90 days per visit.
Per entry.
Yeah. Per entry.
Yes.
So what they do is they will come on the 1st of Jan, as an example, and they will say, my days expire on the 30th of March. Meaning, on the 30th of March, then they will exit, and then 1st of April, they come back. And then they will count another 30 days. I mean, another 90 days, which is 3 months.
Yes.
And that is the problem. So where is the problem that we have, particularly for South Africa? The problem is the system.
Yes.
So we don't have a system that is at least able to do the proper counting. And guess what then makes even more difficult?
Yes.
Because the issue is no longer even about a system, but it's about a passport.
Mm.
When the police find you in the country, they have no system to verify.
Oh, yes.
They only have passport to see.
Or so no knowledge, or even no knowledge of what you have just explained. The police are lay land forces. They will not know this immigration rule.
Yeah, so the issue is, Fresh, they are going to look at your passport. If your passport, the date it was stamped when you entered here is within the 30 days, from that day to where they find you, then they check, they said, oh, you are proper, you are in the country legally, but you are not.
But surely we're at a stage in technology where, like they do at the border, where they scan your disc.
Yeah.
You scan your disc and it'll tell you the car's history,
if
it's been stolen. So for instance, my Baki was hijacked 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And I had to go clear it.
Yeah,
that has been found, recovered.
Yeah.
But when you scan it at the border,
it
still appears that this car was once stolen.
Definitely.
And it gives all the details.
Yeah.
If it's owned by the bank, it does that. Why can't there be a similar tablet that scans a passport and goes to the database and says, this person entered 6 months ago, and then they went to Lesotho in and out to reset their days.
Yeah.
Surely it's literally a software away.
You see, Fred, I think you will be aware of what we are busy doing now, especially this year, which we are going to amplify, is the rolling out of the ETA, what is called Electronic Traveler Authorization.
Yes.
And we are going to actually roll out facial recognition at the ports. That is going to be our ultimate resolution or solution for all of this.
Yes.
If you remember the president in SONA, he did amplify that point. That is exactly what we are going to be doing. So we are going to be rolling out a system that is going to do all of these activities. Mm. The next step is that the Immigration Inspectorate, which are from Home Affairs, when they operate inside the country together with the police, they will also have a device where they will have to then put somebody's face on that device to check if they're in the country legal or not.
Yes.
No longer depending on the passport. Mm. Remember what used to happen? When you now depend on the passport, these guys, they take passports, they give them to somebody.
In bag, to the private.
It goes to the border.
To go stamp. Yes.
Yeah, and they go find some people there who are actually stamping passport for 500 rands.
But commissioner.
And that is a problem, which is why last year what we did, 1st of August, we introduced new stamps that are highly sophisticated, and we dealt with those syndicates.
I've been under the impression that, and I don't know whether it was a trial, I may be mistaken, that in order to cap that before the facial recognition and the new stamps that introduced, and they are just like the bank stamps, you know, we know that it's belonging to this officer.
Definitely.
The biometric,
yeah.
Because once the biometric system was or could have been in place,
definitely,
that a person is no longer only the stamp,
but it's also
biometric. If that person comes back via the bush, they will not have updated on the system. What happened to the biometric system? Wouldn't it have been a better option in absence of the devices that law enforcers can carry?
Yeah, you see, when we talk about facial recognition, it is advanced level of biometric, trying to move away from just the finger. The biometric in terms of the facial recognition is the latest tech that we want to introduce. However, the older, finger-based biometric, as you will know, it was implemented.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate part, I think you will be aware, there were some bit of challenges around the network, the bandwidth, and all of those kind of issues. So that on its own had kind of slowed down that particular process. And that is why now we are now moving to the latest. And in moving to the latest one, we're also going to amplify the network platforms where these systems are supposed to sit. And that is going to be the solution for all of these issues.
Yes, sir.
Because that is the center of all of these problems.
Mm.
The people that keep coming here, for example, and say that we are here to visit, because the 90-day per visit is for that purpose.
Yes.
You go and visit a country, maybe you go to Botswana, you go to Galagadi, whatever, you go see animals there. They know 7 days, holiday done, you come back.
Yes.
If you visit again, you will still visit. You won't finish 90 days. Mm. I mean, honestly, that's 3 months. So they know that you are not. But what people do, they come through the port, and then they say, we are visiting South Africa. And as they say they're visiting, they come here, they go work.
Mm.
People's houses,
yes.
Go work in people's gardens,
mm.
and then they don't go until Good Friday and until December.
Yes.
Now, the problem with this, unfortunately, is when they leave, when we realize they overstayed, guess what we do on the system?
Mm.
We V-list them. V-listing them means we are then saying we are now banning you from re-entering South Africa for the next 5 years because you have overstayed in the country.
Okay.
Now, what happens after that, the person now goes to the bush because they know that they are no longer authorized to enter South Africa through the formal
platform.
Yes.
Hence, now we have to start running after them in the bush. And that is the difficulty. Another complexity is Lesotho. Lesotho is in our belly. We have a lot of Lesotho young people V-listed because they overstayed in South Africa. Now, it means if you are in Lesotho and you are V-listed by South Africa and you want to go to anywhere in the world, let's say anywhere in Africa, not by flying, but on the road, you can't go.
Mm. Oh, yes, because they're landlocked. Yeah.
Because you cannot go.
So is there a solution for that, or are you saying it's none of our business?
You see, Fresh, that is what we are discussing. And I say to the Lesotho people to say, guys, that is a policy issue.
Yes.
And those are the issues you must go discuss with the Department of Home Affairs.
Sure.
From a BMA, we implement as it stands.
Yes.
And unfortunately, people can't go to Namibia. They can't go to Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
They can't go anywhere.
Nearby,
unless they fly.
Mm.
Another one, which is even more scary. If they fly and they fly to somewhere else and they want to come and transition or transit at OR Tambo,
they can't.
The system will flag them.
Ah.
And then we are going to stop them from where they're trying to fly.
Yes.
And say, you are V-listed, you can't fly to
South Africa. Now they're stuck there.
Even if you are transiting, then they are forced to either fly to another country to go and fly to Maseru, for example.
Going back to the SADC issue.
Also, the commissioner has to run soon, so we must wrap up.
But that's probably my last question. It's just an opinion.
Mm. Yes.
We had a policy as a country. People who are abusing the 90-day SADC visa allowance for member states, and some countries they don't even need passports anymore. You know, Botswana, Namibia, and Zambia have just signed a deal now. You can move without passport. South Africa had a policy position whereby it is the discretion of the immigration official to say, yes, you qualify for 90 days, but since you say you are coming for shopping or for just a visit, you are going here on holiday. And I see you have booked your hotel for 7 days. I'm giving you 10 days. You don't have to actually give people 90 days entry stamp. And I think it could help in managing what we explained earlier on to say it's being abused. This thing is being abused. Maybe we should re-implement and reinforce the discretion of the immigration official to say, yes, you are allowed 90 days, but according to your hotel booking, we are put for 7 days. I'm giving you 10 maximum.
Yeah.
I think that will aid the situation as well.
Yeah, Muda, that doesn't work, because what you are saying is in instances where people will comply, because people are not much about the exit part. They are much about the entry part.
Yes. Okay.
Whether you give me 1 day or you give me 10 days or you give me whatever, it doesn't matter. Keep what matters is for me to enter. When I enter, I overstay anyway.
And
that is what the problem is.
Because you can't legislate against intentions.
Yeah. And that is...
If my intention is to stay the whole year, I'm going to stay the whole year.
Definitely. Definitely. And if they can't find you in that whole hair, you are in. And that's what you wanted.
Absolutely.
And that is where the abuse is. But once we can get the system, and then we get facial recognition, inside the country we have the inspectorate and the police going around with devices, then they will be able to catch the people.
Yes.
And by the way, solutions are there. Somebody was giving me an example to say, in other countries, they do have cameras across all places where people congregate.
Yes.
Let's say in malls. As part of those cameras, when people are busy walking in the malls, the cameras are busy checking their
AI face. Is picking up.
The moment they pick up a person who, according to the system, is in the country illegally, they just walk to you when you are still busy going shopping, all of that. Yeah.
And rights doesn't allow, our constitution doesn't allow that.
So
our human rights part, section 2B of the constitution, will not allow that.
Yeah, so maybe
will not allow people to be monitored through the
in public areas without them knowing. Remember the part where a person has to be known that you are actually watching.
No, you'll just put in a sign there to say everybody is under
surveillance.
Under surveillance.
Area under surveillance.
Yeah.
You are inviting NGOs into your office.
Or maybe it's time to have a conversation about which parts of the constitution are working against the country.
I think so. I think we should have a conversation as a nation.
Yes.
About revisiting our constitution.
If ever there was a need for a referendum,
it's now. Yeah.
I think that is the political part.
We are out of time.
Yeah.
But just quickly, I traveled between America and Canada.
Yeah.
And the border was drive-through. Yeah. I was in Lesotho last week.
Yeah.
The border was drive-through.
Yeah.
What are we waiting for?
We are waiting for infrastructure.
Yes.
Which is why we are actually going to be doing the redesigning and redevelopment of our top 6 land commercial ports.
Yes, sir.
That is Bade Bridge to Zim, Lebombo to Mozambique, and it's Oshuk to Eswatini. It's Maseru Bridge and Fix back to Lesotho, Koffontein to Botswana.
Yes, sir.
They are going to be redesigned and redeveloped. We are going to ultimately have the lane just for the trucks, where we are going to have even green lane.
Yes.
We are going to have what we call authorized economic operators traveling without stopping at the port.
Mm.
They're just going to come with number plate recognition. The boom opens. SARS would have worked on the consignment and everything.
Yes.
They go to the other side.
Mm.
In terms of the small vehicles, exactly that. So they're going to come through into a particular lane where it's going to be a drive-through without having to park the car and walk into the port.
Yes.
All of those things are coming. The reason why we're not able to implement, because our infrastructure did not allow that.
Mm.
If you go to Maseru, as you say, the infrastructure in Maseru on the Lesotho side is more better than the infrastructure on our side. And that is why on our side we are not able to implement that.
Absolutely.
But once we implement this, by the way, we are going to be announcing the successful public-private partner soon. And once that is done, they start working. They are going to open up the ports and we are going to implement exactly that.
Sure.
Yeah.
Are we done?
We're done, fresh.
In closing.
I'm done.
In closing, how do you measure your success? Is it arrest? Reduced inflows, economic protection. How do you sit back in the evening and say it was a good day? How do you measure your success?
There are two areas.
Yes.
The measuring of the success on the basis of facilitating people movement
Yes.
is on the basis of the waiting times around the port and the ability to process people as efficient as possible. Mm-hmm. That is how we measure ourselves. Yes. And we are able to get the feedback on that very straightforward from the travelers themselves. Mm. The people who have been traveling across ports will tell you comparatively,
yes,
if they were to cast their minds backwards some 3-4 years ago versus now, they will tell you that at least now things are a bit better, mm, a bit smoother. So that is how we get measured on that part. In terms of the movement of cargo, which is trucks, again, we get measured by how we are able to do end-to-end movement of the trucks, how long do they wait on the corridor, and all of that. Mm. That is how we measure that. Now, the one that is difficult to measure is the illegal aspect.
Yes.
So the illegal aspect, we actually measure it a bit in the reverse side. Mm. And that is where sometimes people actually were telling me, who never understood our work. They said, you actually buy drones, you buy body cams, and you go on TV, you tell everybody, we have drones, we are seeing you. They said, why are you doing that? Don't tell people when you have the drones. Mm. I said, remember, our work is not policing. You're not SAPS. Mm. We are not looking for criminals. Mm. The police don't have to announce themselves because they're looking for criminals.
Yes.
Our work, part of the core of our work is deterrent.
Absolutely.
So when we have a lesser people attempting to enter the country illegally, yes, that is our success.
Then you're winning.
When we have more and more people walking into the country illegally, then we are, yes, failing. And I want to give a typical example.
Sure.
In the 24-25 financial year, I mean, a festive period, we intercepted 58,000 individuals, mm, in the period of 10 days, 10 December until 15 Jan, in 24-25. And that was at the time before we could implement the drones.
Yes.
But once we have the drones out and we tell people we can see you on screen, once you attempt, we are going to arrest you. We started arresting the facilitators. This year, we only had 26,000.
Okay. That is 50%. So it's working.
Half.
No, it does work.
Yes.
It does work. And the people are able to also tell. Hence, I give you another example about the buses.
Yes.
It's another way to assess our work, mm, to say before you will... You'll stop taxis and buses with a lot of illegal people in.
Sure.
But when there is lesser and lesser of those incidences,
yes,
it's already showing you, absolutely, that we are doing something. Absolutely. And that is how we measure ourselves.
I have a suggestion for your drones.
Yeah.
Since they also fly a bit into the other country.
We don't fly them into another country.
Or they can zoom in.
Yes, zoom.
They definitely can zoom. Yeah.
Can't you also throw a voice and say, yay?
No. No, I
agree. We are watching you.
Because if the drone can, yeah, throw a voice and just say, yay.
We see you, go back.
Trust me,
yeah,
you won't have to deal with the paperwork,
yeah,
of now having to deport people or send them back. Just add voice. I'll even borrow you my voice if you want.
Let me. Yeah, and that will be powerful. That will be powerful. Maybe let me say, yes, indeed, Fresh. That is a functionality in a drone.
Yes.
And the current drones we have don't have that functionality. Mm. So it's about a functionality. So what we actually have said is when we get a bit additional money,
yes,
we will definitely buy the drones that have that kind of capability.
Mm.
Because we would want a drone that would be able to fly around, you take it a bit low, and you are able to tell the people, we see you,
yes,
go back.
Absolutely.
Because that is basically what is going to be the fundamentals of our success.
Yeah.
We agree with you. And we'll definitely take
I'm ready. Off. I'm ready.
With the voice.
If Lebatla voice has it's one I can even work on my Shona and Debele.
Yeah.
Yes. So I'm available if you
can. You know, no, that's great. We'll take you off on that.
Mm. B, we're done.
No, we are done. Let me just thank Dr. Commissioner Masia Pato for making time for, you know, the wow hashtag Politricks. Like I said, we hardly have a guest, but because of the call of the followers and what we follow in our assessment, what are the people talking about? We don't talk politics, actually. We speak more of government administration.
Mm-hmm.
And you taking time and you know, sitting with us and having a conversation. We don't do interviews.
Mm-hmm.
I always tell people, this is a conversation with Dr. Masia Pato.
Mm-hmm.
And for that, thank you very much.
And one of the reasons we agreed we need to get you in here is, one, you're one of our favorite people.
Oh.
Two, because we see the work you're doing,
yeah, doing,
and we understand you're working under pressure. You're working with limited resources,
mm-hmm,
but you're getting done what you can with what you have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people like that need to be reminded that we see you. Mm-hmm. Keep it up.
Awesome. No, so, thank you very much.
So thank you for the great work you're doing, and may you get more budget and more staff, and may you keep the country's borders safe.
Great. No, thank you very much, Fresh. We really appreciate the opportunity. And Dadamula, we really appreciate this. For me, it was very much inspiring.
Yes, sir.
For me to come and have a conversation with people of your caliber, and of course for you, it's even hectic because
yes,
I grew up looking on you doing your stuff.
Yes, sir.
So even in this instance, it reminds me of those days.
Absolutely.
Yeah, awesome. So otherwise, it's very much.
So would it be a conflict if I'm hired to play at the BMA staff party end of the year? Now that you've disclosed that you know me from back in the day.
No, we'll look at that. But you know, these days, you can't even hire some.
I know.
Yeah, it's very hectic.
Yes, Doc Commissioner, thank you very much.
Awesome.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Wow, What a Week, hashtag Polytrix, talking all things BMA, Commissioner Dr. Marcia Pato. We're back again next week. We are coming to you from Amped Studios is not where we are. We're coming to you live from Discover TV. Let them be your stage. Shout out to Trevor and his crew at Pezulu Works for all of the cinematography. And Keletso Modisakeng is our executive producer. From myself, Fresh Le Botsang, we're back again next week. Till then, have a wow week in spite of yourselves. We're out of here.